allies delivered symbolic health care invoices to House Speaker Mike Johnson's office to point out the multi-generational costs for their families dealing with cancer due to radiation exposure. Once inside, advocates pressed for Speaker Johnson to bring up the bill for a vote. Outside, advocates like Kathleen Soucy prayed for a new path forward.
I prayed for Speaker Mike Johnson to change his mind and have the heart and the compassion, as well as the House of Representatives, to change their mind and approve the RICA bill.
It was a stark contrast to Tuesday's meeting with senators who have passed expanded versions of the RICA bill and representatives who say they have the votes to pass it if Johnson would bring it to the floor for a vote. I'm Yvette Fernandez.
Trust and visibility are keys to effective health care, but not everyone feels the same way walking into the doctor's office. That's why some are looking to increase representation among healthcare professionals. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keen has more.
The new Great Plains Native Health Hub in Rapid City aims to create a safe space for Indigenous patients, but it also wants to be a resource to aspiring healthcare professionals. Dr. Donald Warren is the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Indigenous Health, a key piece of the new Native Health Hub.
What we're excited about is bringing together many of our people who have studied in different parts of the country or worked in different parts of the country but have roots here in South Dakota. And bringing our team back here to conduct this work is very exciting. So what we're hoping is, again, we'll link the research opportunities to educational opportunities.
Warren says Indigenous First Healthcare makes a tangible difference for Native patients.
What we're recognizing when we blend together the best of our traditional cultural values with the best of modern science, we create all kinds of opportunities and synergies to improve outcomes.
Warren's colleague, Dr. Courtney Clausen, says while it is a difficult path, Native students shouldn't write off healthcare as an unachievable career field.
Incredibly strong community ties and community connections that are very, very strong pillars of success for those who are seeking higher education, and certainly helped myself.
The leadership team at the Great Plains Native Health Hub is made up entirely of Indigenous peoples. I'm CJ Keen in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 26, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Suzanne Potter, Eric Tegadoff, and Mike Moen. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. Next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. War in Lebanon. Can U.S. arms to Israel be stopped? And Republicans and other former senior officials endorse Harris and call Trump unfit. First, the war in Lebanon. In international conflicts, we often find a disconnect between high-level diplomatic activity and actions on the ground that make diplomacy seem detached from reality, such is the case now in the Israel-Hamas war. On one hand, we have ongoing negotiations on a ceasefire that clearly are going nowhere, and we have the United Nations voting against Israel's expanding settlements in occupied territory. I'll deal with the latter development shortly, but first, we have Israel's war with Hezbollah. Israel's planting of explosive material in pagers and walkie-talkies has proven to be the forerunner to an invasion of southern Lebanon. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant implied as much when he said those explosions are, quote, the beginning of a new era in this war. Israeli fighter jets overflying Beirut reinforced the message. As I speak, casualty figures approaching 600 are being reported from southern Lebanon. Civilians are fleeing. A full-scale war between Israel and Hezbollah, which all parties supposedly wanted to avoid, seems unavoidable. An Israeli government spokesman, asked whether Israel's air assault in southern Lebanon amounts to a declaration of war, said, quote, Hezbollah needs to be ejected from Lebanon. Prime Minister Netanyahu's chief rival, Benny Gantz, agrees. In the lead-up to this new era, the exploding devices killed 37 and injured at least 3,000, including an unknown but significant number of Hezbollah fighters. And the Beirut bombing apparently killed Ibrahim Akil, a top Hezbollah commander. Most observers see Hezbollah as having been badly hurt, but still having the numbers and armaments to deal with an Israeli invasion. As Daniel Byman at Georgetown University says, such a war would be devastating to both Israel and Lebanon, and might not fundamentally change its strategic equation, despite the high cost it would impose. Hezbollah has a massive rocket and missile arsenal, and it could overwhelm Israeli missile and air defenses and strike civilian and infrastructure targets throughout the country. Even if Hezbollah suffered significant losses, the group has many supporters in Lebanon and, with Iranian help, could rebuild its forces and a few years down the road pose just as much of a threat to Israel, unquote. Politically, this new era means that Israel's war with Hamas is now tied tightly to its war with Hezbollah. A ceasefire in Gaza cannot be accomplished without a stop to the escalation in Lebanon. As Professor Byman notes further, quote, it would be politically difficult for Hezbollah to accept a deal that reduces its presence near Israel's border and otherwise make concessions as it is being openly humiliated by the explosion of those devices. But there is no deal in the works. The latest Israeli proposal to Hamas, as reported by the Times of Israel, September 19, indicates no interest in a ceasefire. Quote, Israel has put a proposal on the table that would end fighting in the Gaza Strip and give the head of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar, safe passage out of the enclave in exchange for the immediate release of all hostages held in Gaza, the demilitarization of the Strip, and the establishment of an alternative governing power there. Hostage families were ecstatic, but Hamas was hostile. It immediately rejected a plan that would remove it from its governing authority in Gaza. How could it not? What this latest Israeli proposal shows is that Netanyahu remains as committed as ever to total victory, which includes retaining full control of Gaza and the West Bank. The latest report goes even further, saying that the Israeli leadership is apparently considering a proposal for the complete removal of Palestinians from the northern half of Gaza. The expanding war makes a mockery of the United Nations' latest effort to restrain Israel. The General Assembly passed a non-binding resolution in support of an historic advisory ruling in July by the International Court of Justice, the ICJ. The ruling urged Israel to cease, quote, its unlawful presence in the occupied Palestinian territory as soon as possible and stop all settlement activity there immediately, unquote. The General Assembly resolution was passed by 124 votes to 14, with 43 abstentions. Britain and Australia abstained, while the U.S. voted against. Noteworthy about this resolution are three things. First, it follows on the ICJ's ruling, giving it greater authority. Second, it was presented by the Palestinian delegation, a first since its status was upgraded in May from observer to allowance to present resolutions in the UN. And third, it urges members to impose sanctions to end the import of products originating in the Israeli settlements and to stop the provision of arms, munitions, and related equipment to Israel, quote, if it is reasonable to suspect that they may be used in the occupied Palestinian territory. The Israeli delegation offered a particularly harsh condemnation of the resolution. Israel's UN ambassador, Danny Danon, described the vote as a, quote, shameful decision that backs the Palestinian Authority's diplomatic terrorism. Instead of marking the anniversary of the October 7 massacre by condemning Hamas and calling for the release of all 101 of the remaining hostages, the General Assembly continues to dance to the music of the Palestinian Authority, which backs the Hamas murderers, said Danon. Can U.S. arms to Israel be stopped? The U.S. vote against the General Assembly resolution I just discussed was consistent with its military support of Israel. Progressive members of Congress have been trying for the past 2 years to move President Biden to impose restrictions on U.S. arms transfers to Israel. These members have cited Biden's own directive, which is supposed to ensure that such transfers comply with domestic and international law governing humanitarian aid and human rights abuses. The usual approach in congressional legislation has been to distinguish between defensive weapons aid, which would continue, and non-defensive arms transfers, which would end. All such efforts have thus far failed to have an impact on U.S. policy, despite the administration's admission of violations of the law by the Israeli Defense Forces in Gaza. Now, the Washington Post reports that the inspectors general for the State Department and the Pentagon, quote, are preparing to publish the results of multiple investigations scrutinizing the Biden administration's provision of U.S. arms to Israel for its military campaign in Gaza, and several related inquiries are either underway or planned. Those investigations apparently stem from complaints within the Defense and State Departments that U.S. and international law has indeed been violated. The inspectors general received, quote, a letter from dozens of federal employees spanning more than 30 agencies who accused the watchdogs of failing to conduct proper oversight of Washington's arms policy. As the Washington Post also notes, quote, the investigations come as some of Washington's closest allies, including Britain, Canada, Japan, the Netherlands, Spain, and Belgium, have restricted military equipment transfers to Israel because of legal and political concerns that the weapons could be used to commit war crimes. Now, Senator Bernie Sanders has resumed a quest to place a full embargo on U.S. arms transfers to Israel. Chances are his proposal won't get support even from those senators who want to limit U.S. arms to Israel. Still, spotlighting the crucial role of U.S. arms in a conflict that has led, according to many observers, to war crimes and genocide is surely important. Republicans and other former senior officials endorse Harris and call Trump unfit. Since Kamala Harris's campaign began, quite a number of former Trump officials, military and civilian, senior military officers, and Republican office holders from previous administrations have endorsed her. In all cases, unfit to be president has been the chief objection to Trump. Now we have a particularly powerful endorsement of Harris from 111 former Republican officials, including those who served in Trump's time. Though the letter expresses some disagreement with the Democratic agenda, its main thrust is underscoring what makes Trump, quote, unfit to serve again as president or indeed in any office of public trust. Here's a sample of their reasoning, quote, we firmly oppose the election of Donald Trump. As president, he promoted daily chaos in government, praised our enemies and undermined our allies, politicized the military and disparaged our veterans, prioritized his personal interest above American interests, and betrayed our values, democracy, and this country's founding documents. In our view, by inciting the violent attack on the Capitol on January 6, 2021, and defending those who committed it, he has violated his oath of office and brought danger to our country. As former Vice President Pence has said, quote, anyone who puts himself over the Constitution should never be President of the United States. The letter has this to say about Vice President Harris, quote, Vice President Harris has demonstrated a commitment to upholding the ideals that define our nation, freedom, democracy, and rule of law. Her experience as Attorney General of California and her leadership on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and as Vice President have helped prepare her to be President, unquote. In another open letter endorsing Harris, 741 former high-ranking national security officials, including 233 general and flag officers, 15 four-star generals, 10 former cabinet secretaries, and 10 service secretaries, as well as leaders who served in Republican administrations, all said, quote, "We do not agree on everything, but we all adhere to two fundamental principles. First, we believe America's national security requires a serious and capable commander-in-chief. Second, we believe American democracy is invaluable. Each generation has a responsibility to defend it," the letter continues. "That is why we proudly endorse Kamala Harris to be the next president of the United States," quote. The letter calls Trump impulsive and ill-informed. In other news, California sues ExxonMobil over plastics recycling. In a one-of-a-kind lawsuit, California is suing ExxonMobil, a major contributor to plastics manufacturing, for having engaged, quote, in a decades-long campaign of deception that caused and exacerbated the global plastics pollution crisis. For decades, says California's Attorney General in a statement, ExxonMobil has been deceiving the public to convince us that plastics recycling could solve the plastic waste and pollution crisis when they clearly knew this wasn't possible. ExxonMobil lied to further its record-breaking profits at the expense of our planet and possibly jeopardizing our health, says the statement. The advanced or chemical recycling process pushed by Exxon would have people believe that all plastics are recyclable, when in fact only about 5% is in the United States and far less elsewhere. Most Americans support mass deportation of illegal immigrants. According to a survey by Scripps News Ipsos, about 54% of respondents, 86% of Republicans, 58% of Independents, and 25% of Democrats said they strongly or somewhat support a wide-scale effort to deport millions of immigrants, and 59% said they are closely following the immigrant situation at the U.S.-Mexico border. A third of respondents in the poll said securing the U.S.-Mexico border should be the first priority on immigration, while 18% said mass deportation should be at the top. It would seem that the Trump-Vance anti-immigration message has gotten through. The U.S. seeks a base in Iraq, but Iraq may not be offering. Since 2014, 2,500 U.S. troops in Iraq have served as part of an international coalition of forces. Now the Biden administration is seeking a permanent U.S. base. But foreign troops on Iraqi soil is highly unpopular. Iraq's prime minister says, quote, "The justifications are no longer there. There is no need for a coalition. We have moved on from wars to stability. ISIS is not really representing a challenge," unquote. But Washington isn't worried so much about ISIS anymore as it is about Iran. Iraq, however, is seeking more balanced relationships in the region and just last week hosted Iran's new president on his first visit abroad. A stabbing in China causes a diplomatic row with Japan. China's top diplomat has urged Japan to calmly handle last week's fatal stabbing of a 10-year-old Japanese schoolboy in the Chinese city of Shenzhen and, quote, avoid politicizing or exaggerating the issue. But Japan's foreign minister has demanded that Beijing deal with, quote, unfounded and malicious anti-Japanese social media posts. China's foreign ministry assured Japan that China will investigate and that it, quote, always protects the safety of all foreign citizens in China, unquote. But that claim is far from the truth. Japanese have regularly been targeted by Chinese, and this latest case was preceded by another attack on a school bus with Japanese students earlier this year. Anti-Japanese feelings often manifest in China, and Beijing usually tries to calm it down. But Japan's strengthening strategic ties with the U.S. have aroused considerable anger on China's internet and may have been responsible for these latest attacks. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I am speaking with Street Roots Editor-in-Chief Kay Rambo about a letter from the editor that they've written for this week's paper. It's called Street Roots Joins ProPublica's Local Reporting Network. Welcome to the show, Kay.
Hey, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Congratulations are in order about this letter to the editor joining this network. But part of this covers how Street Roots itself works. Maybe we can start there. How has Street Roots grown during your tenure as editor-in-chief?
Well, it's the organization itself has grown a lot, obviously, with the new building that we'll be moving into shortly. You know, the staff has grown quite a bit as, you know, the kind of fallout of the pandemic has continued, and homelessness has gotten worse. For the newspaper specifically, I mean, when I started at Street Roots, I was the Zool editing fellow. There were no staff members on the newspaper. Some outgoing folks were, of course, kind enough to give me information, and certainly some contract folks who came in early on to provide some historical knowledge about the paper. But for a minute there, it was just me putting the paper out every week, which of course is a lot. And then Kanani Cortez joined as our editorial producer at the time in the fall of 2021. I started in July 2021. We were able to hire our first reporter 6 months later, and 6 months after I got there. And then our second reporter that summer of 2022. And then, you know, there's been some changes since then. And we currently only have one staff reporter in Jeremiah Hayden. Kanani Cortez is still at Street Roots, now is the digital producer. And last year we were able to hire an illustrator and designer. So we're currently a four-person team.
So what does this new partnership with ProPublica mean for Street Roots?
It means a lot. I think the biggest thing is it adds a second reporter, which will be me, which is really exciting. We will be contracting somebody to handle the kind of day-to-day of putting the newspaper together, editing stories, receiving pitches, things like that, to allow me to really focus on reporting full-time in addition to the kind of big picture, maybe more traditional editor-in-chief roles of, special issue planning, making sure standards overall are adhered to. So I'll just be kind of on the editing side, making sure that the paper continues with the momentum that it currently has and maintains the standards that it has for readers. And otherwise, I will be reporting full-time, doing investigative reporting on homelessness in Portland.
That was going to be one of my questions of if there is a particular subject matter that you've set your sights on so far.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really trying to look at, the causes and possible solutions of homelessness. I think, of course, money is part of that. Policy is part of that. I'm just kind of going to be digging into all of it to see what we come up with.
For folks who may not follow local media as closely as we in the local media do, how does Street Roots' structure and approach differ from other print papers in town?
Well, we are the only print nonprofit outlet in town. There are some web-only nonprofits that are based in Portland. We are the only print newspaper in Portland that's a nonprofit. So that's a huge difference. I think our editorial scope is also different. We tend to focus on investigative journalism. The kind of broad description I give for what we cover are stories related to equity, really trying to look at, who's in power and who isn't and who might be harmed by powerful people and their policies. What could the city and its residents do to improve life for marginalized populations in Portland? Isn't to say that other newspapers don't report on things like that. We are just a little different in that being our singular focus as a paper.
And what is ProPublica's role in creating this? I mean, I think I can intuit that there's funding involved, but I'm curious about that aspect.
Yeah, ProPublica, you are correct about the funding side. They are paying for me to work at Street Roots for the next year, which then allows us to hire that person to fill in the editing side, you know, so it expands our reporting capacity by 100%, which is really exciting. You know, the other big things are, you know, ProPublica is really well resourced as an outlet. They, you know, I think very kind of counter to the trends that we see in journalism. ProPublica is growing. It has a data team. It has, you know, research teams. Like, there are a lot of resources that a place like ProPublica has that obviously a smaller newspaper like Street Roots doesn't. And that's really the point of this local reporting network, is to try to help, you know, papers with fewer resources in markets where there's a lack of investigative journalism, which unfortunately is just about every market at this point. You know, and it's really to try to provide those resources to papers so they can do work that they otherwise would not have the resources to do. And that also includes, you know, an editor to help guide me along the way and, you know, make sure I'm doing my job well as a reporter.
I don't know if there's a specific answer to this, but why now? Is there a significance to this coming about at this particular moment in time, or this year we have ahead?
Well, I mean, you know, we are joining ProPublica's local reporting network through its 50-state initiative, which launched earlier this year, and their goal is to put at least one, you know, accountability and investigative reporting project in every state over the next 5 years. We are going to be part of the second cohort. They're selecting five projects at a time. So, you know, I mean, it works out, you know, worked out well, I guess, with the timing that they had. I think maybe part of why our project and our paper is interesting to a place like ProPublica is just all the national attention that, and really international attention that Portland gets for homelessness. You know, and I think that's really it. And then I think there are things that are just kind of happenstance. Like, this is the 25th year of Street Roots being around. You know, we've got this new building that we'll be moving into. You know, and so there's just kind of these big steps being taken by different parts of Street Roots at the same time. And I think this is one of them for sure.
For the rest of the paper this week, any other articles that our listeners should be looking out for?
Yeah, I mean, there's some really great pieces in this week's paper. Jeremiah Hayden has an incredible story about a Habitat for Humanity development where the residents are concerned that it may not meet fire code, and it's been very difficult. You know, early documents showed that it did not meet fire code, and then it ended up being approved, and the fire department is not, and the city are not being terribly forthcoming with details as to why it was approved or what's different about it now that makes it safe. So that's a really interesting story. And I think the structure of Habitat for Humanity homeownership is really interesting. I think there's a lot of things in there that people probably don't know that are really interesting. We have a great feature this week on Street Soccer PDX, which provides soccer leagues and other resources to folks living on the streets, unaccompanied minors, and folks with disabilities. So that's a really great story. And then we also have a piece from our community media director, Devon Pouncey, about the recently announced WNBA franchise coming to Portland. Devon has been following that for years and has had a lot of conversations with Senator Wyden about it, who Senator Wyden was a driving force in that taking place. So it's a bit of an inside look, and it's something we've all heard about at this point, but, you know, I think a different lens than you would get elsewhere. That's really interesting.
If our listeners are interested in finding those stories or your letter to the editor, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way is always to go find a vendor. Oh, and I'm very sorry, but we also have a piece about ranked choice voting that is extremely important, that really gives readers a good breakdown of how that's going to work this year, as well as the new geographic districts that people are part of for the city council race. So I have to mention that one too. As always, if you want to read it, the best way is to go find a vendor. If you're not sure of where they are, my advice is to go look at our vendor profiles, where vendors will often say where they work and what hours. But if you're not doing that, go somewhere busy at a time when a place is busy, and you will typically find a vendor. And if all of that fails, our work is free to read at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, thanks for having me. And go buy the paper, please.
Thank you, Kay, and congratulations.
Thanks so much.
That was Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, speaking with me about a letter to the editor they published this week. It's called Street Roots Joins ProPublica's Local Reporting Network. A year-long partnership between Street Roots and ProPublica seeks to shed light on Portland's homelessness crisis. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News in Depth,
I'd like you to meet a friend of ours who goes by the name of Killer Joe. Picture a so-called hippie or hip cat standing on a corner in a neatly pressed, double-breasted, form-fitting pinstripe suit, a pair of pointed-toed shoes with bold white stitches around the soles, a black shirt, long white tie, a black pencil mustache, and, of course, a very wide-brimmed black felt hat. Killer Joe always has a pocket full of loot, but only the kind that jingles. You see, he likes to play the horses. He is most certainly a ladies' man. As a matter of fact, he is always willing to accept cash contributions from them.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
This week on That Vegan Show, we are highlighting vendors of the Compassionate Living Festival, which occurs September 28th at North